This week's episode was brought to you by Anakin B and Jaina B. Or is it Jaina Bia? I'm not sure. Thank you, Anakin B and Jaina Bia. It's with the generous support of listeners just like you that helps keep our intrepid team of miniaturized quantum drone operators navigating the cavernous Underdark and the treacherous forest of Tutankhamun's mummified nostril hairs in hopes of uncovering the true identity of the time-traveling thief who keeps stealing our stash of plutonium nighboard. If you'd like to help us continue our vast-reaching investigation, or just hear the second half of this episode, then please visit www.patreon.com/thewholerabbit, where your monthly donation of just $5 will not only get you immediate access to our entire library of extended episodes browsable conveniently within the Spotify app, after logging in, of course, but not only that, I'll send you a high quality 5x5 sticker of our Big Bunny Baphomet cover art, and you'll get the secret keys to our Discord server, where you can talk to us about the gargantuan UFO that keeps surfacing off the coast of South America. If you're enjoying the free section of the show just fine, and would rather save your $5 for a travel-sized pouch of My Little Pony print band-aids, then please consider giving us a like, subscribe, or share on your social media platform of choice. On the flip side, if you'd like to support the show and would like a monthly tarot reading from yours truly, our $20 a month tier is for you. For a limited time, our $10 tier and above will receive a special holographic Burl Bunny's Militia insignia designed by Mari-sama herself, my favorite. If you're anything like me, you'll have a blast vandalizing your place of work with them, so don't miss out and subscribe now. On this week's episode, we dive into part two on our series of Dion Fortune's quintessential occult classic, Psychic Self-Defense. First, we kick things off by discussing the often claimed yet poorly understood phenomena of interacting with people possessed of non-human souls, how drunk sex creates them accidentally, and the psychic danger of geography over-concentrated in currents of elemental energy. We also touch upon the dangers implicit in ceremonial magic, how to deal with lunatics, how to create your own psychic attack from scratch, and the dangers of accidentally becoming involved in a black lodge. In the extended version of the show, we finally dive into the various methods of psychic self-defense, consecrating holy water, the method of absorbing evil entities, and how to perform both the highly protective ritual of the Rosy Cross and the greater banishing ritual of the hexagram. Thank you, and enjoy the show. I went to a psychic. I knocked on her front door. She yelled, "Who is it?" So I left.
Fair enough.
Went to a psychic who was in a bad mood. Then I saw a clairvoyant who was really grumpy. Now I'm just trying to find a happy medium.
I like that one.
What do you call a fat psychic?
What?
A four chin teller.
Oh, man.
You can't say that.
Okay, fair enough. But why couldn't the fortune teller have children?
Why?
Her husband had crystal balls.
Oh, wow.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Whole Rabbit, where we don't just tell you how to spiritually intimidate the forces of earth, wind, water, and fire using a consecrated dagger, some geometry, and a little imagination. Nay, we tell you how to boss around the planets, too. Take a proper psychometric specimen and destroy astral goblins by eating them, because this week we're discussing part two of our series on psychic self-defense, using Dion Fortune as our guide with a little hermetic magic thrown in for good measure. I'm your host, Luke Madrid, also known as Hack Rabbit. I'm joined this week by the Moon Queen of Mayhem, Mari-sama. The monolith of merrymaking, Malachor 5.
Hola.
And the haloed helper of high-profile heists, Hecca Astra.
Hello.
In our last episode, we covered quite a bit from Dion Fortune's occult classic, Psychic Self-Defense. A well-loved text, to say the least. But to say we left a few morsels behind would be an understatement. Turns out, there's a lot of ways to get your aura all bungled up. By the end of this episode, we hope your aura will be well fortified against any bungling or shenanigans of any sort. Before this episode is over, you will know how to get the archangels to unbungle your bunghole.
This book, ID on Fortune psychic self-defense is kind of considered to be like a staple. At least it used to be. Something that you should read before you even get into doing occult practices.
I think it's a true statement that here on The Whole Rabbit, we skipped a bunch of shit. So now we're kind of just going back to the first steps we should have took, maybe.
Back to the basics.
It's not a bad idea to review it anyways, even if you are an experienced occult practitioner. So.
We even showed folks how to properly masturbate just a few weeks ago before we taught them the pentagram ritual.
And by the end of this series, people will know how to banish the satanic demons they accidentally invoked doing said things that we taught them how to do. So as we discussed last week, most psychic attacks are unintentional, and they come about in numerous ways, including cranky psychics and panic-stricken ghosts. What makes the next metaphysical culprit so intriguing is that while often romanticized in modern spiritual paradigms, especially of the New Age variety, in psychic self-defense, Dion Fortune describes them as anything but. These are, of course, what we now call star seeds, walk-ins, hybrids, moon children, avatars, angel incarnations, etc., all of which fall under the umbrella of non-human souls. Harkening to tradition, Fortune introduces the subject by referring to the folk belief in fairies, who are well known to occasionally kidnap babies and replace them with their own, a more archaic incarnation of the myths frequently shared in New Age circles. You know, like I'm a Pleiadian, etc., etc. Well, of course, having alien or fairy DNA gives you cool points at the Reiki Crystal Healing Sound Bath Workshop. According to Dion Fortune, it's actually a bit of a handicap and paints you as somebody people should avoid.
There are many of us who have met people who might well be described as non-human, soulless, in that the ordinary human motives are not operative with them, nor do the ordinary human feelings prompt or inhibit them. We cannot but love them, for they have great charm, but we cannot but dread them as well, for they spread an infinitude of suffering around them.
Does anyone pop into mind for you?
Probably me.
Well, this of course is entirely accidental, and something that could barely be helped. While those possessed of non-human souls are not inherently evil, they are described as being singularly detrimental to all whom they have contact, which anyone who spends long enough in the New Age rave or festival scene will eventually discover for themselves. These sorts of people, as they claim, do in fact feel alien, and often as if every man's hand is against them, which as they advance in age develops into, quote, puckish malevolence, often falling short of calculated evil doing.
Okay, maybe not me, but yeah, I know some people like this. I'm more of a happy-go-lucky type. So she continues on, gratitude, compassion, good faith, morality, and common honesty are utterly foreign to their natures, as far beyond their conception as differential calculus. They are not immoral, however, but simply non-moral.
It's not that they do bad things on purpose. They just don't have a purpose. That being said, it's not all bad, though. They're also said to often possess virtues of absolute sincerity and great courage, although lacking in any normal spectrum of ethical fiber. Dion Fortune says, quote,
they have an ethic of their own to which they are loyal, and that is the beauty which is truth, and this is all they know, and as far as their life is concerned, all they need to know.
I feel like if you have a pair of LED light gloves, you may be one of these people.
Shots fired. Oh my gosh. Sounds like a certain kind of stereotype that you know.
Well, I think I might be one of these people. That's why I know so many of them.
White people. No, I'm just kidding. Joke.
Yo. Yeah, maybe just a little bit.
I think I might be white, guys. Just saying.
Oh no. So she continues to describe them. In social relations, they take violent likes and dislikes. They show a facile and demonstrative affection towards those they like, but quickly forget them. Gratitude and pity are unknown to their nature. Towards those they dislike, they are pettily malicious, and in all relations of life, they are utterly irresponsible. One cannot describe them better than to say that they resemble nothing so much as a blend of Persian kitten and pet monkey. Oh God, that sounds terrifyingly cute.
Yeah, I want one.
It'll eat your face off. Be careful.
And won't remember your name afterwards.
Yeah.
I won't take it personal.
And then they won't share their drugs with you. Fortune also mentions that people often have a potent and immediate response to them. While some people are immediately repulsed, the word Dion Fortune uses is actually hate.
But I am telling you right now, that motherfucker back there is not real.
Others find them enticingly exhilarating to be around. She suggests that, based on her experience, you're more likely to give birth to one if you conceive while under the influence of booze.
Uh-oh.
Quoting another one of her texts, Fortune goes into some detail on this.
She says, at the moment of sexual union, a psychic vortex is formed, resembling a waterspout, a funnel-shaped swirling that towers up into other dimensions.
Are you ready for the waterspout?
As body after body engages, the vortex goes up the planes. In all cases, the physical, etheric, and astral bodies are involved. The vortex, therefore, always reaches as far as the astral plane. A soul upon the astral plane may be drawn into this vortex if it is ripe for incarnation, and thus enter the sphere of the parents. If the vortex extends higher than the astral plane, souls of a different type may enter this sphere. But such extension is rare, and therefore it is said that man is born of desire, for few are born of anything else. But this vortex may not only extend vertically up the planes, speaking metaphorically, but it may also, under certain conditions, be deflected, as it were, out of the normal human line of evolution, so that it's open and extends into the sphere of evolution of another type of life. Under such circumstances, it is theoretically possible for a being of parallel evolution to be drawn into incarnation in a human body. Occultists hold that this occasionally occurs and explains certain types of non-pathological abnormality which are occasionally met with.
That's how they made Vetus. Fortune seems to imply that folks with non-human souls are less likely to enjoy city life and find peace in places of vast elemental power and energy, like a mountain, or the ocean, or a vast forest. And while these are wonderful places to settle down, we are cautioned against getting hitched to one.
There is nothing more disastrous than marriage with a non-human, for they have nothing in their nature that can satisfy the normal human yearnings for affection and sympathy.
You must love me exactly as I love you.
Well, I don't love you. And to be honest, you're starting to get on my nerves a bit now. If anything, I find you're slightly pathetic. So deal with that.
Maybe I will deal with it. Maybe I'll deal with it the way I dealt with Curly Jefferson.
The one saving feature in such a union is that grounds for divorce are invariably readily available, for the morals of the non-human are those of the barnyard. Oh, geez. The effect they have upon those who love them constitutes such a well-marked syndrome among the psychic pathologies that we must consider it in detail. The person who forms a rapport with a non-human becomes deeply stirred by the elemental forces that find ingress into our sphere through the channel of this wandering and alien soul.
Sometimes it's the MDMA.
Could be. She continues, he becomes, as it were, drawn away from the normal human things and set wandering upon the confines of the fairy kingdom, and yet he can find there no rest for his foot and no sustenance for his soul. The story of the handsome fisher lad and the mermaid is indicative of this condition. She loves him, draws him to her, and he drowns, for he cannot live in the element of water.
I think this is an interesting thing to say. If we consider the Holy Guardian Angel and the quote-unquote alchemical marriage, some believe that the HGA is, in fact, perhaps a non-human soul, and the goal is to kind of bind yourself to it and, in fact, exist in a world where, yeah, she is right. You're not going to be human-like anymore. You're going to transcend a little bit, but still be here in the mortal human flesh and have the capability to still operate like a human. I guess it's implied, like, on death of the physical body, since you have your HGA, you're going to have a body ready and perfectly fit for you on the other side. I don't know. That's just me riffing off of what Fortune's saying here, telling me not to marry my HGA.
Well, now hold on a minute. I could be wrong, but if Dion Fortune were here, she would probably say something like, you gotta find something that you love and let it kill you. Being the Holy Guardian Angel, you need to be able to give yourself to the Holy Guardian Angels. If the HGA says jump into the ocean, well, you better be ready to drown. But I think what she's talking about in this passage is, like, let's say you're a woman that fell in love with Pablo Picasso or Diego Rivera or, you know, Marilyn Manson. Like, it's not a fun time. These people don't have normal human relations, you know?
Well, I mean, she specifically pointed out that, you know, compassion and morality and honesty are foreign to them, so you're gonna have a bad time.
How does it work? Tell me how it works.
It seems I would think that those are characteristics that your HGA would have.
Get married to your inner Jim Morrison, not to Jim Morrison, I think is what she's saying.
Find your counterbalance. Got it.
You want to transcend your humanity, not constantly fall short of it because the dick is so good. Okay, so on the flip side, though, where New Agers and evangelicals often dip their big toe into conspiracy theory, Dion Fortune tends to disagree that the titans of industry and otherwise powerful people who dominate the world with evil or cunning are, in fact, non-human souls, as these types of people often struggle to even navigate the normal human lives that they have. Meaning, Bill Gates, Charles Schwab, and the royal family are probably not blood-drinking reptilian devil souls. Just that one girl in your friend group named Becky. You know, the one wearing the Moldavite eye bracelet is always doing E at work and is actively trying to seduce your boyfriend?
Yeah, fuck Becky. Dion goes on to elaborate, it must be clearly realized that any mating between a human and a non-human is a hopeless proposition. In the first place, it can only be the preamble to a divorce because non-humans are promiscuous in their sexual habits. And secondly, there is nothing in the nature of a non-human that can satisfy the higher aspirations of the human. We must not allow the human form to mislead us as to the existence of a human soul. A non-human is a pet animal, not a fellow creature. That, frankly, is the only possible ground upon which they can be approached. If we expect no more of them than we should of a pet bird, if we manage them as we should manage a kitten, we have got as near to the solution of the problem as we are ever likely to get until the dark angel mercifully restores them to their own kingdom, a mercy seldom long delayed, for non-humans do not make old bones.
So they don't live long lives?
No, they burn themselves out.
Oh.
Sounds like some Bloodborne stuff.
You know, they're here for a good time, not a long time. More than just Jim, I think the whole 27 Club is worth a look into this category. But of course, encountering non-human souls does not always occur through a human incarnation. As you may imagine, they are often not possessed of a human body and tend to dwell near areas rich with the element they correspond to. These are some of the same ones invoked by more advanced students of the occult. Salamanders of fire, undines of water, they're kind of like mermaids, sylphs, spirits of the air, and of course, gnomes, of which Hecca is a thief, a gnome thief.
Used to be.
You could say her crimes are well known.
Good one, boss.
So on this note, we may recall that it was a superfluous invocation to the sylphs which kicked off Rose Edith Kelly's psychic episode, which in turn culminated with receiving and transposing Thelema's Book of the Law. Likewise, they can be riotous in the affairs of human life, but in their human incarnated counterparts, people will often seek them out because they're just so damn stimulating. To a certain degree, this is normal, but too much of a good thing can quickly become bad. This is true, apparently, even just spending time in places overly abundant in elemental energy.
Mountaineers also know this peculiar terror with which the Great Hills can obsess mankind. It is neither giddiness nor mountain sickness, but a curious oppression of the spirits by the overwhelming grandeur of nature. The same force, when not at a poisonous concentration, inspires the passionate love of the hills or of the sea that Kipling has celebrated so gloriously in one of his poems. The pathologies of the element of water may be a fascination so great that a man will walk out into the sea until he drowns. Swinburne had this peculiarity and has immortalized it in several of his poems. Quote, strike out as the heart in us bids and beseeches a thirst for the foam, unquote.
Foam.
Delicious foam.
On one occasion, he was picked up in the open sea by a Breton fishing smack swimming tirelessly many miles from land, borne on the sea by currents, but oblivious of his danger. Being rescued, he sat upon the deck with his mane of red hair drying in the wind, chanting sea poems to his rescuers, a spectacle that one would have given much to witness.
So rum, the man had some rum and went swimming. He went very swimming. Fortune suggests this destructive call towards the elements is in fact deeply rooted in the nature of humanity and correlates with modes of archaic religion.
Is that kind of like the call of Pan?
Yes.
Oh yeah. The call of the wild.
Call to pull your penis out and go screaming through the wheat field.
Yeah, it's Ric Flair in his nature boy mode.
So Dion goes on, these apparently causeless suicides by the water and air are, in my opinion, a form of union with the god, which is one of the ideas underlying human sacrifice. There are two types of human sacrifice, the willing and the unwilling. The unwilling sacrifice, the prisoner struggling or drugged into passivity, is used not to propitiate the god, as is usually thought, but in order that his vital forces may serve as a basis of manifestation.
Oh, no, not the beast! Not the beast!
The willing sacrifice, in which the victim will be either a devotee of the god, has for its motive the idea of divine union, not altogether unknown to Christian mystics, who seek its achievement by a living death, whereas the adherents of Juggernaut escape with one brief pang.
Oh, that's an interesting thing. Juggernaut, its etymological roots are in Sanskrit, and it's like this crushing wheel force. Correct. That people would throw themselves under willingly.
Yeah, to get crushed. Is this where crush fetish comes from?
Possibly. Want to go, Eastern about it, yeah.
So by throwing yourself under this giant wheel, you'd become one with the juggernaut?
I guess so, yeah. They'd watch your body parts roll on down the street in a nice little bloody pattern.
And then you'd be like, I'm the juggernaut!
Gene!
Bitch. Everyone over 30 knows what we're talking about.
Not me.
True to form, Fortune suggests that these inclinations may be partly due to an egregore or oversoul that corresponds to large swaths of land, even affecting us differently based on our racial lineage?
Any organic geographical unit develops something of an oversoul, and where the differentiation is marked, the oversoul may become a very definite entity. If there are among the inhabitants of the district any who are sensitive to the unseen, they may form either an affinity or a repulsion for this oversoul. A great forest has a very marked personality, and there are few white men who can resist its influence, becoming markedly changed and dehumanized if exposed to it for long periods without the companionship of others of their race. Natives, on the other hand, seem to enter into it and be part of it.
Get off my lawn!
I don't know, this is interesting too, because if you're talking about media, and Silent Hill is a perfect example of that, where it's like a specific town or geographical location becomes detached from reality because of its oversoul.
Oh yeah, definitely. In Silent Hill, there's the world of the unseen and the world of the seen. This YouTuber, Max Durat, he also made a video this week explaining how the game Persona, there's an unseen world and a seen world.
Oh yeah.
And, you know, it's starting to bleed into the real one, and you're the hero of the game, so you got to go kill those demons that are all named after goetic spirits and tarot cards and stuff.
Of course.
Because Japan just knows everything.
Japan puts occultism in their games to so much effect, it's frightening. Silent Hill is a great example. If you've noticed, the people in Silent Hill are either like, oh, I feel so at home here. I've always been here. And the others are like, I gotta get out. I hate this place. Why would anyone be here?
It's not even just in Silent Hill anymore. It's like a global phenomenon in lore, whatever.
I just got done watching the anime Serial Experiment Lane, and that's from the 90s, but it's literally about the internet bleeding into reality.
My old profile picture was Lane hugging Tony Soprano.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it was really good.
Very good anime. Go check out that shit.
The Sopranos?
No, Serial Experiments Lane.
The next source of psychic threat is the kind we inadvertently call upon ourselves playing with the spiritual fire of magic, especially in its weaponized form of ceremony and ritual. Long story short, there's quite a few ways to get burned. For the unfortunate, however, the most pressing thing to get across is the ontology of evil in general, so we can arrive at a practical approach for dealing with its influence. To do that, the unfortunate invokes the abstract model she works best with, the Kabbalistic Tree of Life. As one of the foremost experts on the topic, Fortune explains that the Tree of Life and the Klipoth, or Tree of Death, its dark twin, are much more connected than we may at first consider. This is something we've mused about on the show quite a bit. According to Fortune, the Klipoth, the abode of all evil in the universe, comes into being in a way that reflects the meaning of the word Klipoth as being a peel or shell of the fruit we know from the Tree of Life. In essence, each Sephiroth on the Tree of Life is not created individually. The first overflows to become the second, which then overflows to become the third, so on and so forth. Based on the description given in the text, the Klipoth are the extra parts of the overflow that did not fully absorb into the newly created and balanced Sephiroth. Leftovers, basically. Sometimes described as shattered vessels, these shells or peels contain the divine light of God, but they are, by their nature as vessels, opposed to what they contain. In so many words, Fortune explains evil merely as a thrust block, a sort of springboard for good to launch itself off of. That being said, to contact the good side, one automatically comes into contact with the bad. This is abundantly obvious for anyone who's gotten a little too excited in their early phases of magic and just started calling on archangels and planetary intelligences. Like, if you call upon Jupiter, you're gonna get some good Jupiter, but you're also gonna get some obscene ones. You know what I mean?
Yeah, he's kind of an ass. But he's strong.
Hey girl, I heard you like gooses.
Show me that cloaca.
I feel like if Zeus turned into a goose, he would still just have an enormous dong. That goose has two necks.
It's just like his pubes are a storm cloud. It's all epic.
How the fuck am I supposed to segue back to divine emanations after goose cock? Throw me a bone here.
Are you saying your rooster wants a bone?
Oh my god.
A goose cock is when you put a goose with a rooster.
Oh my god.
Ooster.
The whole gooster.
Oh jeez. So Dion Fortune says, the 10 divine emanations are personified as archangels, and the 10 infernal emanations are personified as archdemons. It is these which are the names of power and magic. Each Sephiroth, then, has its obverse side in the corresponding Klipothic demon. Ziggy, stop.
Speaking of Klipothic demons, please continue.
The initiated adept always gains control over the demonic force before he attempts to utilize the angelic force, which, by the appropriated means, can be contacted in each sephira. If he does not do so, he contacts them both simultaneously. The initiated adept is exceedingly careful what he does when he is working with these potencies, because he knows that he has always got the clip-off in the background. The uninitiated occultist goes ahead gaily, juggling with such names of power as he has picked up from the innumerable books on the subject, now available for the general reader. Thinking if he does not invoke the demons, he will not get them, he forgets that every planet is a Jekyll and Hyde.
Man, that's so well put, and she kind of gave me an episode idea here to talk about the spheres and the angels and the demons of each.
I absolutely agree with what she's saying here, 100%.
Yeah, I think she's probably correct. When you call upon the higher, you are automatically put in contact with the lower.
I mean, even if you are not doing Kabbalistic specific workings, even if you're not doing ritual specific magic, I think that you can see this in a lot of circumstances where you see people who are really into love and light type stuff. And you'll find that if you only focus on the love and the light and you don't do any shadow work, you're actually not that great of a light worker. Like, it tends to be like when you start to go down one path, you kind of inadvertently have to deal with the other, whether you like it or not.
Yeah, they ignore it, which creates an opening by doing that, by being so polarly focused on one side of the coin without realizing that you have to take in both sides and unite them is the object goal.
The best light workers that I've seen are the ones that have done a lot of shadow work. So,
yep.
Agreed.
Riffing off of the discussion here, real quickly, the ancient Egyptians understood that Ma'at was the way, but that Isfet, chaos and disorder, also had to exist to support the very idea that there was order in the first place. You can't have one without the other.
You can't have light without shadow.
So if you call upon Venus for love, you may also get some lust and toxic charisma in the mix as well, if you don't have Venus perfectly balanced in your energy, which if you're not an adept is probably the case. And even then,
in the tarot episodes, I also included some of the archangel names associated with some of the cards. And she brings up a point here that the spheres themselves also have an angel name associated with them. And that's a whole other side of ceremonial magic that you can practice and get into if you're getting bored of the basics.
So while the Tree of Life and the Tree of Death are the same tree, in terms of the Kliphothic side specifically, Fortune describes them as a sort of repository where all the evil that has ever been done still resides, waiting for someone stupid enough to crack the seal and let them back out into the world.
Like a Pandora's box, maybe?
Yes.
To these spheres go, according to their kind, all the evil imaginings of the heart of man that are not neutralized by the repentance or compensated by the overplus of good in the other members of the same group soul. When we consider all that must have been poured into these 10 sinks of iniquity since the days of Atlantean magic, through the decadence of Babylon and Rome, down to the Great War, we can guess what rises up from them when their seals are broken.
Right around then, the German's like, hold on, hold my beer, I have to break the seals and see what happens.
Suddenly Nazis.
Well, fortunately, cracking a seal is usually the result of ceremonial magic gone wrong rather than listening to the wrong type of music or playing Dungeons and Dragons, as the paranoid evangelical would have you believe. That being said, there's an uncanny amount of people who, entirely new to the occult, cannot help but start mucking about with the most dangerous things they can find first. Fortunately, as Fortune explains, in most cases, these trigger-happy newbies are often saved by their own inability to get results, adding that when they do, serious trouble is unleashed.
Even an experienced occultist may get into difficulties if he attempts magical work when he is in bad health, overtired, or has even a moderate amount of alcohol, for very little is too much when the invisible forces are being handled. Equally does this apply to each of his assistants. A chain is no stronger than its weakest link, and if one of the team cannot handle the forces, everybody is going to suffer. A ritual lodge is no place for the well-meaning ineffectual.
I do have some pushback against this, but if she's talking purely about high magic, you can't be high while you do that.
Yeah, don't bust out the heptiarchy when you got a fever of 104, but if you're a little bit sick, don't use that as an excuse to skimp on your daily banishing if you're doing hygienic rituals. Just push through if you're doing the basic stuff.
Crowley says otherwise, though. He's all about, like, you know, do drugs and find your pleasures and just do your will, your true will, so that you're not lying to the universe. Like, if you're an asshole, be an asshole, you know? But the best rewards go to those who are in line with their own truths and honest. So I get what she's saying, though. She's definitely right that being sober in some of these more important things is absolutely the way you should be doing things.
Well, maybe wait until after you get over from COVID before trying to intimidate Asmodee into building you a new bicycle or whatever the hell you're doing. Okay, then there's the issue of magic cooties, which according to Fortune is quite prolific. It's a real problem.
I hate magic cooties.
I just keep giving them to you.
No, I like yours.
Oh.
Do you two need a room or can Mari read?
No, yeah, that's what I was about to say.
I've been needing a room with Luke for like 3 years now.
So I can put some magic cooties in that booties.
Oh, no. Get a room.
No, Dad, no. I don't want to hear what you do with Mom. Fortune continues. One buys secondhand books on magic. Who was the previous owner and for what purposes were these books used? Or one buys a new book which has been bought out by some occult school for propaganda purposes. These books are often magnetized before they are sent out, and so form a magnetic link between the purchaser and the order which caused them to be issued. Or someone may join a group who has previously been associated with another cult group whose contacts were debased. Unless the proper precautions are taken, that person will bring the psychic contagion in with them, and its fellow members may have unpleasant experiences.
All your OTO friends? Cooties. Cooties for days.
Well, on the bright side, if you're sensitive, you can get a feel for it, you know, when you're looking at books, or even if you're a secondhand shopper, thrifter, go to thrift stores kind of thing. If you're specifically using something for ritual purposes, I would definitely think again.
You know, as a kid, I hated thrift stores because of the magnetism inside of them. It's like I felt dirty and filthy and disgusting and gross. And like, I was not like a prim and proper child either. Like, it was purely a psychic feeling. Now that I'm older, I recognize it and it's not so overwhelming.
Well, and also like some people are more sensitive than others. You know, maybe not everyone is going to be able to feel it when they're looking at it. Maybe they're just too stoked that they found the book in the first place in a thrift store or what have you. But I think this is pretty decent advice overall.
Fortune even warns that if one should suffer an attack during a hastily prepared ritual, the damage has the potential to extend well into one's physical health. As she explains, it's possible for the weakest link in the ritual to short out, which is described sometimes as if one has received a hard punch from an invisible pugilist.
Ow! She says, when picked up, you will be very dazed and badly shaken, and will certainly be some days, possibly weeks, before he gets over it. He will be in a state of complete prostration and considerable mental confusion, which will gradually wear off. Unless there is some organic defect, such as hereditary mental instability, a bad heart, or hardened arteries, there will be a complete recovery, given time, but naturally it is a bad outlook should one of these conditions be present, and those who have them should not take part in occult experiments. You got a bad heart? Got a bad heart?
Well, this sounds kind of ableist at first. Fortune launches into a story about a friend who was mysteriously found dead, naked in the snow, clearly in the midst of some ritual. She had been possessed of a poor heart, but Fortune suspected that she probably found herself unable to return to her body while astral projecting, and if she ever did find her way back, it was long after her body had frozen to death. So you can die doing magic. Magic is a little bit like autoerotic asphyxiation that way. You really should have a spotter, you know? Fortune also reminds us that not everything is caused by paranormal means, nor are a number of the dangers we face on the path. For instance, it is well known that between members of occult organizations, there seems to be a considerable potential for high school-style drama, but with wizards and cloaks and wife swapping. It also happens that some people are just mentally unstable.
In one case which came to my hands for help, the victim declared that he was being persecuted by a telepathic suggestion. I inquired as to the origin of this persecution, and he said that some people who had lived in the next flat used to sit in a circle and concentrate upon him. I asked him why they did this. He did not know. I asked him how he knew they did it, and he could not tell me. He merely reiterated that they did it, although he admitted he had never been inside their flat, never, in fact, spoken to them, except to exchange a good morning on the stairs. Sounds like a paranoid schizophrenic.
On this note, people who are currently suffering from mental delusion and psychic attack should seek help for the first before dealing with the second, and for good reason.
This brings us to the practical part of our considerations. How far can the methods of ritual magic be applied to the relief of mental disease? They are undoubtedly palliative, but they will not produce a permanent cure unless the origin of the disturbed mental condition found and cleared up. Unless this be done, as fast as we disperse the phantoms, they will reform, because the mental mental state of the patient is invoking them. Under such circumstances, no magic circle can be kept intact. As fast as we break the rapport with the abyss, the patient renews it.
It's a little bit like when your muscles are tense and you get a chiropractic adjustment, the tense muscles just pull everything out of alignment again. But despite this advice, we're told later in the text that intermittent exorcisms can help interrupt the hold that evil entities have on the subject, which then allows them to get proper medical health. So it's a bit like a two-pronged attack, which is the most helpful.
So take your meds and do the exorcism.
Yes. Although this may wander too close to conspiracy theory for some, Dion Fortune appraises us that there also exists the implicit danger of the Black Lodge. What is the Black Lodge, you may ask? In short, it's any occult organization which has accidentally or purposefully wandered on to the left-hand path. While genuine initiation often makes effective use of methodologies that some people would call right-hand path and others left, it is often presumed in the world of occultism that two factions exist which seek union with God but through different means. Although the truth is more nuanced. The left-hand path is often described as the selfish, power-obsessed path which skirts the domain of evil, while the right-hand path is conceived of being in service to others, and it's all sunshine and rainbows. At least that's how the Unfortune tends to describe it. We of course find a ubiquitous trope in fiction, where a set of good wizards square off behind the shadows against a group of bad wizards in a bitter struggle to control reality. Apparently, this happens in real life, too.
She says, occult powers are not infrequently used to obtain purely mundane ends. Therefore, when the question of ordinary criminality occurs in connection with an occult organization, the issue may be complicated by an admixture of methods that belong to another plane. For owing to the secretive nature of its proceedings, the fraternity form of organization lends itself to various forms of lawbreaking. One occult organization is well known to have been involved in the drug traffic. Another is riddled with unnatural vice. A third degenerated into what was little better than a house of ill fame, and its head was an expert abortionist. Others have been involved in subversive politics, those who join fraternities without properly investigating them and the credentials of those who are running them may find themselves involved in any or all of these things. Oh no, not abortions!
Well, you could probably do too many of them for the wrong reason. But yeah, it just, to me, this is like a perfect explanation of the arguments for and against the satanic panics and all this other stuff that's going on in the zeitgeist right now.
I mean, it is kind of, you know, throwing a political alignment in with drug trafficking.
Well, no, not exactly, because some cults have been documented to use abortions for blood rituals. So
yeah, but that's along the lines of law breaking.
But it's legal.
Not if you're coercing the person to get it done.
That's true.
There's like a fine line that's going on with that, though.
Very touchy political subject.
That's why I'm saying that she's throwing it in with various forms of law breaking when it on its own is not technically that. I mean, I guess it depends what state you're in.
In all such cases, especially ones involving blackmail, Fortune advises, perhaps a bit naively, that, quote, the one and only remedy in all such cases is to place the matter in the hands of the police. Of course, those of us who spent a little too much time chewing lead paint chips are probably thinking, what if the police are involved, you big dummy? One minute you're enjoying the satanic orgy and suddenly you have to pee, desperate to find a restroom somewhere in the long, cold, winding hallways of the medieval castle. You accidentally walk in on Uma Abedin eating a bowl of toddlers too. You can't just call the police. You gotta ask for a bowl yourself.
And what's to say the police would not even believe you in the first place, even if they weren't involved?
Maybe they're already there eating the soup. Manners are very important in the Black Lodge, after all. Jokes aside, it's not too far from what Fortune says herself.
In ancient times, and among primitive peoples, human sacrifice was a common incident in connection with occult practices. It is not unknown in Eastern Europe, even at the present day. The nursery story of Bluebeard has its origin in the practices of the infamous Gilles de Rais, Marshal of France and comrade of Joan of Arc, who slaughtered innumerable children and youths in connection with his magical experiments. I have never heard of a case in England, but there have been at various times some curious killings reported from the United States, which looks suspiciously like ritual murders. But in the absence of adequate information, it is impossible to come to a final conclusion upon them. There recently came into my hands, however, a book upon magic published for private circulation, in which the statement is made that the ideal blood sacrifice is a male child.
Why do I get the feeling she's talking about Aleister Crowley and Friends again?
Crowley and Friends, this Saturday at 8 a.m.
I like how she says that the English would never eat babies.
Yeah, but guess what? It's Prince probably Andrew. Happened. Yeah.
Prince Andrew would like to have a word.
Jimmy Savile. There's so many.
When they do, their pinkies are up?
Probably.
We're also warned that occult lodges sometimes get very passionate about political activity, but because lodges tend to operate independently of each other, it's unwise to assume a vast overarching conspiracy. Furthermore, it's usually a red flag if the organization you're joining is asking for ridiculous sums of money. Kiflam, brother.
There's lodges that work outward, and there's lodges that work inward.
Towards your wallet.
That's what I heard.
So apparently Scientology is a legitimate lodge.
It's legitimately expensive, and you will have nothing when they're done with you.
I'd like to know more about that, but I don't want my legs to be broken.
Human trafficking.
Thank you, Tom Cruise.
Okay, so now we know every possible direction a psychic attack could come from. How do we go about creating an effective attack ourselves? I mean, what methods do the bad guys use so we know how to, you know, stop them? According to our text, there are three relevant factors when creating a psychic attack.
The first of these is telepathic hypnotic suggestion. The second is the reinforcement of the suggestion by the invocation of certain invisible agencies. The third is the employment of some physical substance as a point d'appui, point of contact, or magnetic link.
Then we must consider the power source.
The force employed may be used as direct current, transmitted by the mental concentration of the operator, or it may be reserved in a kind of psychic storage battery, which may be either an artificial elemental or a talisman.
The first factor, hypnotic suggestion, has already been well discussed, although, in my opinion, this is a misleading way to explain the first step. In essence, the first step is all about focus. We are told that, esoterically speaking, emotion functions a bit like electricity and flows towards where the mind directs it with focus. This, fortune warns, carries with it a sense of momentum, which is an important factor to consider. For instance, when she claims that if one has been focusing on healing for a considerable amount of time, then no luck will be had suddenly changing towards magical acts of destruction and vice versa. We must get, quote, charged up, so to speak. This is where the second factor comes into play. Once we have the appropriate force focused upon, we may use this focus combined with ritual to amplify the chosen force through invocation of the right energy. Dion Fortune explains how this could be done using Martian energy as an example.
Let us consider a concrete case of someone who wants to avail himself of a fighting force. He would have recourse to a ceremony of the planet Mars. He would therefore gather together in his temple all that was appropriate to Mars. He would drape his altar with a scarlet cloth. He would himself wear a scarlet robe. All his magical implements would be iron, and his rod of power would be a naked sword. Upon his altar, he would place five light, five being the number of Mars. Upon his breast would be the symbol of Mars, engraved upon a steel pentagon. On his hand would be a ruby ring. He would burn sulfur and saltpeter in his thurible. Then, according to the work in hand, he would call upon the angelic or demonic aspect of the fifth sephira, Geburah, the sphere of Mars. He would invoke either the deity name in Geburah, calling upon the god of battles to hear him, or the archdevil of the fifth infernal habitation. Having performed this mighty invocation, he would then offer himself upon the altar as the channel for the manifestation of the force.
So, some blood would be preferable here, it sounds like.
I just heard Dion Fortune gasping from the grave. Even the Satanists don't use blood. Like, Temple of Set's like, you know, use cherry juice. In essence, you become the lightning rod for the invoked force. The next step is to find a ground for the energy within the auric bubble of your victim, so when the energy is dispersed, the protective shielding of said aura is pierced. This is achieved through establishing a magical link with the target. This may be done in one of two ways.
Fortune says, the usual method is to obtain some object which is impregnated with the intended victim's magnetism, a lock of hair, nail paring, or something habitually worn or handled. Such an object is magnetically connected with its owner, and the sorcerer can work up the trail and thus enter the sphere of his victim and establish a rapport. Then he proceeds, as does any other practitioner of suggestion who has succeeded in getting his victim into the first stages of hypnosis. By means of the magnetic link, he has gamed the psychic ear of his victim, who will hear his suggestions subconsciously.
She left out signatures. If you have a signature that's got like meaningful intention, you can use a signature as well.
Oh. She goes into that in her book, saying that that's not as potent as some of the other items that she lists. And I think the reason why she said that is, like, for instance, with a letter, it is usually connected to another person or another idea as well. So if you have a signature, it's connected to an idea of a contract or another person by way of letter. So the energy of that person that's being targeted is not as strong as it would be with hair.
True. But if they're not a magically inclined person and you want to psychically attack them and they have no defenses, a signature can work in certain circumstances. Having their blood, their nails or teeth or hair, of course, is better. But if all you have is a signature, it can be used as well.
If a magnetic link cannot be made, the second method involves magical substitution.
Something is chosen and by means of ceremonial identified with the intended victim. For instance, a small animal may be baptized with the victim's name and then immolated, usually with torture. The operator, meanwhile, concentrating upon the personality of the original. Oh, that's fucked up, by the way. The old device of making a wax image and melting it before a fire, or driving nails into a wooden statue, baptized with the same name of the victim, are frequently met with the records of witch trials. The actual driving of the nail has no conceivable effect upon the victim, but it helps the concentration of the operator.
In the Book of the Law, it tells us to put your cakes of light on your altar and wait for bugs to come and try to consume the cake of light that you made and smash them, naming your enemies to curse them. Kind of the same thing.
Interestingly enough, I recently was listening to an interview of a voodoo practitioner in New Orleans, and she mentions that the conventional idea of voodoo dolls are kind of a misconception, in that the act of putting the needle through the doll is more, like she says here, a device of concentration. You can also use healing spells with them. It doesn't have to be to harm the other person. It can also be to heal them of ailments.
You know, because if you drive a nail into a doll, you're probably imagining driving a nail into a human figure. So that makes sense.
Well, it's like a visualization strategy. So whether you're healing or hurting, I think it could work for both ways, but this is kind of like, I guess it's just like a graphical rendering system that you can view what you're actually focusing on.
Like you're saying that if someone had lung issues, that you could have a doll or an effigy, some kind of likeness of the person, and then use the needle as like a concentrated idea of like, I am sending healing to this part. I'm going to imagine it like a straw sucking out the badness.
Oh man, I'm just thinking of the Green Mile and what is it, John Coffey? I forgot what his name is, but he's like a conduit for the pain to leave your body and heal people. You know, the guy that they accuse in the Green Mile of committing the murder of the little girls, but he's actually like a spiritual healer. I don't know why I didn't bring this up earlier, but that movie has some of this psychic defense, psychic healing present in it, it seems. And that's a Stephen King novel.
You could just put Vicks VapoRub on the doll.
Yeah, you could.
Play some Dead Mouse.
I mean, Vicks VapoRub isn't likely to get rid of COPD or like, you know, lung cancer or something.
But a nail will.
I mean, maybe.
That's what the rave gloves are for. Reiki. I'm gonna Reiki that lung cancer out of you. So picking up where we left off last episode, we've already accounted for the physical component of psychic attack by referring the victim to a doctor for proper medical examination. After all, just being sick can cause for an exacerbated sensitivity to psychic phenomena, with Fortune citing diseased blood as a reason for delirium or hallucination. In such cases, it is advised that guided meditation and creative visualization is a helpful relief of such symptoms. Lastly, because frauds of the mentally unstable can be quite convincing, a proper medical examination has the tendency to filter out these poor subjects. Physical considerations out of the way, we are left to determine if the source of the attack is from a person or something of the non-physical variety. Strangely, the process going forward is not unlike a medical one, and that first a biopsy is taken. And, like the ones taken in a hospital setting, the psychic ones have some nuanced procedure involved as well. The psychic biopsy, or as Fortune dubs it, psychometric specimen, must be of something charged with the magnetic resonance of the subject being diagnosed.
She says, a garment recently and habitually worn, a lock of hair, a piece of jewelry, all these can be made to serve provided that they are properly preserved. Crystalline substances such as precious stones. They hold magnetism better than anything else. Metals are also good, whether precious or otherwise. A pocket knife, for instance, will hold magnetism well. Wood holds it badly, and so do paper, wool, cotton, and artificial silk, especially the latter. Silk and linen are good, though. India rubber is useless. Glass depends for its holding powers upon its form. If it is cut so that it will refract light, it can be good. If it is flat and purely transparent like a window pane, it is almost useless. Stone is fair, earthenware poor. An elaborate article is not as good as a simple article. For instance, a marquee ring is not as good as a signet ring. Letters are apt to be misleading because they often contain nearly as much of the magnetism of the recipient as of the writer. Some psychics can work from a photograph, but this method is not, strictly speaking, psychometry, for the mental image evoked by the photograph is used to pick up the corresponding image in the reflecting ether.
Much like a biological specimen, special care must be taken to avoid contamination by the investigators. Handling a specimen, or even thinking about it too intensely, is liable to cause contamination. For instance, brooding on the problem and theorizing intensely while packing an object away may cause the psychometrist to pick up the thought forms you thought instead of the item. Specimens should be handled physically with great care, using sugar tongs or uncolored virgin silk to make contact with the object. Based on the previous paragraph, India rubber would probably be perfect. Even the packing material is important and should also be virgin, meaning that it has never been used for any other purpose. Birth charts should also be transferred without personal identifiers like printed names to avoid gossip from the astrologers handling it. Fortune seems to assume that astrologers gossip in the way smoke rises or how water is wet in immutable law of nature.
Kind of true, though. They compartmentalize their divinationers.
Resuming the similarities to mainstream science, these specimens are sent away for analysis under blind conditions, so the results can be cross-referenced with each other. While these specimens are out, then a series of interviews can be held to get a better understanding of the situation straight from the horse's mouth. It is done in this way to avoid opinions about the situation from tainting the specimens. So you gotta send off the specimens first, and then hear about the story. I find this particular aspect of the occult truly fascinating, as skeptics are often premature in assuming there can be no overlap between the scientifically rigorous investigations performed in medical science or criminal law with that of occultism. After all, any skeptic ignorant of this point is unfounded in their criticism, and any occultist similarly ignorant will fall short of their potential. On this note, it's not unlike the phrase Aleister Crowley was fond of saying, the method of science, the aim of religion. So yeah, magic isn't just all random, we just make it up as we go along. No, it's actually pretty boring too. The interview should also be performed with care not to arouse the suspicion of the interviewee, as their answers are more likely to conform to the suspicions of the interviewer should they become evident. For instance, if you think the culprit is of a sexual nature, don't ask questions about sex incessantly, or the subject may begin to give tailored answers, etc. Taking notes also tends to place too much pressure on the subject, and the information that they're willing to give usually is of lower quality.
Dion explains, in taking a case history, you want to look for correlations between your patient's psychic experiences and the circumstances of his life. Dates and places, therefore, should be sedulously sought for. When did the trouble start, and where? Having obtained as detailed information as possible on these two points, set out to see whether any occult significance is to be found in it. Note the dates carefully and turn them up in an ephemeris of those years and observe how the moon stood in relation to them, also the planets. Observe whether they fell on or about the equinoxes or solstices. Note also the days of the week upon which they occurred. If you found that all the crises of the case occurred on Thursdays or round about the vernal equinox or at the full moon, you would have a piece of information which was of considerable significance. You would be sure of one thing, at any rate, that you were dealing with a case in which the invisible psychic tides played a part.
Further still, information about the geographical location of the disturbance should also be sought, you know, to make sure it's not on a Black Masonic burial ground or something. In the case of Great Britain, Fortune says that the remains of, quote, very queer cults of the Roman variety are often to blame. Likewise, it's often helpful to visit the location where the disturbance takes place in order to take a vibe check for yourself.
Inquire also concerning any unusual objects in the house, such as images of the deities of primitive cults or savage weapons. It is quite possible that the powerful elementals are attached to these. Inquire whether the trouble seems to lift when the patient goes away to another place. If their reply is in the affirmative, it may be safely presumed that the local conditions are at the bottom of the trouble. But if their reply is in the negative, it does not necessarily follow that the opposite is the case. It may also be that the trouble does not depend on the place, but upon some person residing hiding at the place.
That being said, it can be helpful to look into the subject's associate. You know, in case one of them is a gnarly sorcerer that's known for hexing people, or very clearly dabbling without any hope of following precautions. But if you'd like to hear specifically about the actual methods of defense, how to create holy water, how to close off your psychic centers, how to deal with bullies and intimidators, how to absorb goblins with your aura, and of course our section about hermetic magic where we learn about the Rose Cross ritual,
LVX,
and the ritual of the hexagram, then please visit www.patreon.com/thewholerabbit, where your monthly donation of just $5 will not only get you the extended version of this episode, but you'll get the extended version of all our episodes going back over 4 years, and you'll get the secret keys to our Discord server. But that's like, I'm gonna also send you a sticker that's of the bunny with the boobs. That's our cover art.
That's booby fun. Bunny.
The booby bunny. Not Lola bunny, but the Baphomet. The Bunfomet.
The Boobfomet. I'm hiding in her armpit right now. Thank you, everybody. Eat carrots and shoot lasers.
Beep, beep.